Welcome to Speaking of Palestine. Speaking of Palestine tells the other side of the story of the Palestine-Israel conflict, the side usually ignored by the corporate media. It's a story similar to that of the indigenous people of the Americas, Africa, Australia, and the Pacific Islands, people whose lands have been illegally confiscated by colonizers and whose rights are violated with impunity by occupying powers. I'm your co-host, Rebel Fagan, who, along with your other co-hosts, Therese McGannum, Lois Perlman, and special correspondent Seth Donnelly and Shivis Moore, bring you Speaking of Palestine. And today, we start with Lois, an international update.
Okay, here we go, covering as much of the world as I possibly can in 8 minutes. In a long letter to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, French President Emmanuel Macron wrote that Israel, and this is a quote, Israel's murderous and illegal permanent war in Gaza, end of quote, was undermining the battle against anti-Semitism in France. Imagine that. And he said, Israel's actions will, quote, embolden those who want to use them, meaning, what's happening in Gaza as a pretext for anti-Semitism and endanger Jewish communities around the world. This is French President Macron, who's been a pro-Israel supporter for many, many, many years. Jewish American comedian Adam Friedland said, speaking about the same subject, speaking to pro-Israel Congressman Richie Torres, I think hatred of Jewish people has exploded in this country, and I think it's because of our support of what looks to be an absolute brutality. I'm telling you as a Jew right now that we are receiving more hatred because of what the people with the flag that has a Jewish star are doing to other people right now. And so much for anti-Semitism allegedly coming from the left. So, this is how other people around the world are reacting to the ongoing assault in Gaza. In Hungary, hundreds of Hungarian Jews published a letter denouncing, quote, deliberate starvation, end of quote, in Gaza and calling for peace and justice for Israelis and Palestinians. And this is what they had the guts to do in a far-right country led by Netanyahu's great buddy, Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Now, in Mexico City, where the country is led by leftist President Claudia Sheinbaum, 180,000 people filled the Plaza de Zócalo for a concert by Puerto Rican musician René Pérez Joglar, known as Residente. The popular artist used the free concert as a platform to demand justice for Palestinians as the enormous crowd cheered him on. When Residente's youngest daughter called from the stage, I quote, stop the genocide, the crowd chanted, and I quote again, free Palestine. 180,000 people in Mexico City. Meanwhile, in Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu was falling all over himself, bemoaning the murder of last Wednesday of American right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. Netanyahu called him a lion-hearted friend of Israel, end of quote, and said Charlie Kirk was, this is a quote as well, was murdered for speaking the truth and defending Israel. A street in Netanya, Israel, will be named after Kirk. A mural in Ashdod was painted in his honor, and an Israeli missile was inscribed in memory of Charlie Kirk. Israel supporters in the U.S. also shed tears over Kirk, the 31-year-old founder of Turning Point USA, a nonprofit organization that advocates for right-wing viewpoints on high school, college, and university campuses. Orthodox Jewish spokesman Rabbi Stephen Berg said, quote, he was a steadfast ally of Israel and a courageous advocate for our people, end of quote. Never mind that Kirk was a proponent of what they call the Great Replacement Theory, that says Jews in America are trying to replace white people with immigrants of color, and that many of Kirk's statements were actually anti-Jewish, such as this quote, "Jewish communities have been pushing the exact kind of hatred against whites that they claim to want people to stop using against them." So Israel is dancing around the memory of Mr. Kirk while he is spouting anti-Semitism. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's – oh, I'm sorry. I have to backtrack a bit. Also in the U.S., the State Department announced it is denying and revoking visas for Palestinian officials ahead of the U.N. General Assembly meeting in New York City later this month. And these officials include members of the Palestinian Authority and the Palestine Liberation Organization. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's office called these Palestinian officials backers of, quote, terrorism, and accused them of, quote, waging lawfare campaigns in international courts and attempting to, quote, secure the unilateral recognition of a conjectural Palestinian state. Meanwhile, 147 out of 193 UN member states already recognize Palestine as a state, and many more are expected to recognize Palestine at the upcoming meeting later this month. And here's some breaking news, which we rarely get to report in our monthly international update. In Qatar today, which is some 10 hours earlier than Pacific time, officials from countries in the Middle East and other Muslim countries held an emergency summit to discuss their responses to Israel's drone attack on Doha, Qatar, last Tuesday. According to Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the strike was an attempt to assassinate Hamas leaders Khalil al-Haya and Zahir Jabarin while they were attending a ceasefire negotiation meeting. But this particular attempt was unsuccessful. However, the drone did kill 5 Hamas officials and a Qatari security officer. Qatar called this attack a flagrant violation of international law. And this makes Qatar the 5th Middle Eastern country Israel has attacked in the past 2 years. The other countries include Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and Iran. Al Jazeera's Nida Ibrahim, reporting from Doha, said about this summit meeting, "There's been firm support at this summit for Qatar and condemnation of Israel over the attack, which members say undermines security and stability in the region." Now, exactly what measures the country intend to take was unclear as of earlier today. And somewhere in the beautiful blue waters of the Mediterranean, the global Sumud flotilla, comprised of over 50 vessels and thousands of crew members, is so slowly sailing its way toward Gaza. And here's an Instagram report posted yesterday by flotilla organizers. Mission update. Global Sumud flotilla sets sail from Italy, Tunisia, and Greece to unite in international waters. And this is Dateline Tunis, Tunisia. The Global Sumud flotilla has begun the final leg of its historic journey to help break leaders to help break Israel's illegal siege on Gaza. Yesterday, 18 boats set sail from Catania, Italy. Dozens more will depart from Tunisia and Greece today and tomorrow. And the entire fleet will soon converge in international waters to contribute to contribute, towards Gaza. In the past weeks, the flotilla has faced multiple challenges, including 2 drone attacks on vessels docked in Tunisia, logistical hurdles, and fuel shortages, which delayed our departure to Gaza. Additionally, in light of Israeli Minister Ben Gvir's horrifying threats on flotilla passengers, we underwent additional extensive safety planning to strengthen our security. Rather than allowing these obstacles to derail us, GSF took decisive steps to strengthen our operation, locating some ships to other ports for final preparations, carrying out rigorous sea trials, and adapting our safety protocols. And this is not just some, you know, great paranoid fear of theirs, because 15 years ago, Israel attacked one of the flotilla ships that was sailing in 2010 and killed, I believe it was 9 people on board.
Killed one, but attacked 9.
No, I think 9. I do believe they killed 9.
Oh, okay. One of them was an American. That's where I'm getting the one from.
Yes,
okay.
One of them was an American citizen. The others were not, but they killed 9 of them and injured others, of course.
Welcome to another program of Speaking About Palestine. My name is Seth Donnelly. I'm with Sonoma County for Palestine and Taxpayers Against Genocide. I'm joined by my amazing colleague, Chivas Moore, also with Sonoma County for Palestine. And it's our great honor today to have on the program Rami Abdel Karim, who is an organizer and an activist with the Palestinian youth movement in the Bay Area and is just back from Detroit. So with no further ado, I'll turn it over to you, Chivas.
Okay. Rami, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me today.
You're so welcome. It's our pleasure. So how did you become active in working for Palestine?
Yeah. I'm a Palestinian in diaspora, so I think for a lot of young Palestinians who grow up in the United States, we are disconnected from our culture, we're disconnected from our cultural identity and our politics too, because they're so closely intertwined. And I started getting involved in organizing for the liberation of Palestine in 2021. And this was when the occupation was stealing homes and threatening Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. This was also in the midst of the 2021 war on Gaza. Definitely not, you know, obviously not the last war on Gaza or the first war in my lifetime. But I think, you know, Palestinians like myself who are kind of disconnected from our cultural roots, I grew up in San Diego, I grew up in a pretty white neighborhood. We actually reconnect with our culture through our politics and through our political understanding, that, you know, I'm separated from my people, because of the occupation, because of U.S. imperialism, because of capitalism, and all of the isms, which, you know, Gaza is a way for us to not only reconnect with ourselves and our personal identity, but understand the world around us. So that is kind of how I made my debut in volunteering and volunteering my time and really making my entire life and my life's purpose about making sure that the generations that come after me, whether it's my generation or the ones that follow, are able to experience a Palestine that is truly, truly free from occupation.
You know, right. So many people in this country who are Palestinian are not involved at all. So I always wonder what it is that makes a person step in. Were you involved in other issues before, like anti-imperialist, as you mentioned, or?
Yeah, I did a little bit of on-campus organizing at my university, it was definitely a good catalyst, and I think it also introduced me to kind of like what an organizing bureaucracy kind of looks like what it means to do advocacy within the confines of the university, or what it looks like to lobby or to run a student campaign that follows a specific set of rules. And I think what really drew me into Palestine, other than it being my identity, and obviously, you know, the way that, you know, not only do we have a genocide on full display right now, but we've known that this has been an ongoing genocide, you know, since 1948 and beyond. It was the fact that the Palestine movement is very difficult to be co-opted. It's difficult to co-opt an arms embargo. It's difficult to co-opt from the river to the sea. You know, it's something that is not easy for this movement to be. It runs at so many intersections of money, of power, of genocide, of all of the things that obviously both people on the, you know, when we refer to positions of political power, both political parties stand on the side of Israel, of genocide, etc. So it's a difficult movement to be co-opted. And I think the integrity and really the genuine nature of the Palestine movement brings a lot of people in, and has brought so many people into the streets over the last 2 years.
Oh, thank you. That's like so great.
The tip of the spear against global colonialism, really, you know, and that's so well put. Speaking of that, like, you were part of the Detroit conference. I was there with a delegation of folks from TAG, and it was incredible. Was it 4,000 people that were, I mean, I've never in my time as a, you know, somebody in their mid 50s, I've never seen a conference that well organized, that effective, with that and thousands of people. What are your reflections on the conference? Observations, reflections?
Well, first and foremost, I'm so happy to hear that you were able to make it out. I think that is definitely reflective of how many people showed up. We actually had around 4,800 residents with attendees, sorry, which was really, which is really amazing. And I actually think is a testament to the way that our movement has grown, even in the last year. The 2024 People's Conference, which was at the height of the student intifada in May, had around 3,000 attendees. And this year, you know, it almost doubled. So, in a moment where we have watched 2 years of genocide, we have watched the state come down with repression, the state kind of waging every battle to make sure that people aren't, you know, are dissuaded from advocating for Palestine. We've seen, you know, this record amount of attendees. And one thing that I walked away with is how important it is, especially in this moment, to center the voices of Gaza. This was the second annual People's Conference for Palestine, named Gaza is the Compass, because Gaza dictates the way in which not only we interact as organizers, but the way that we go about our daily lives. This was really an opportunity for me, at least, to recommit myself to Gaza. And for people at the conference to really, truly sync up on the work that we've been taking up for the past year, to centralize as a movement and to reaffirm that Gaza is our compass. And we saw around the, I'm sure you saw this, but the main hall was the Enes al-Sharif Hall, calling attention to our beloved journalist who was murdered by the occupation, in order to restrict the amount of barbarity that the occupation is committing, to restrict actual journalists on the ground, to hear from them, their voices that we recognize, their faces that we recognize, to silence our brave journalists who are doing that kind of reporting and giving us a true eye on what's happening in Gaza. We saw the Hossam Abu Safiya room of Dr. Abu Safiya, who has been in Israeli detention, I think, for over 7 months, who has lesions and who is undergoing psychological and physical torture. Our doctors who are taking their oath to protect and defend life in Gaza, which Israel is working so hard to completely destroy. These are the people we're saluting. And lastly, you know, Hind Rajab. We had the Hind Rajab room of, I'm sure, you know, most of our listeners here today have heard of Hind, who was a 6-year-old girl who was killed in a car with her her family, who was also killed, who called the Red Cross, and the phone call was recorded. It's a harrowing phone call, and who was, you know, left to die in the vehicle. So we do everything that we can. We're affirming that we do everything that we can, not only for our martyrs, but for the living as well. And we walked away being able to sync up on the work that we've been doing. We've seen the way that Israel has really been impacted by the actions that we do in the diaspora. And we know that within the belly of the beast, it's the most important for us to take some kind of action, because we know that we're funding and we're fueling these massacres. So for people to be able to centralize, to meet up, to walk away actually with a central demand of the Palestine movement, to be able to meet up as activists, as students, as workers, as taxpayers against genocide, to listen to speakers like Mahmoud Khalil, who is a Araf, Mohammed Mustafa, who is a doctor who worked in Gaza, to hear directly from these sources and also be able to strategize together is an opportunity that doesn't come very often.
And I know, just to jump in and I'll pass it to you, Chavis, but I know that for listeners who missed it, there's recordings now that are available for people.
Like, yes.
I was thinking also of Hatem's amazing speech too. I mean, there was so much that was mind blowing, you know, and just, yeah. So where, how can people who missed it, how can they access the video, of the speeches?
They can view, most of the, main stage plenaries at the Breakthrough News YouTube channel.
Awesome.
Just so everyone knows, Breakthrough News is where you can find recordings of all of the panels.
And was it PYM that organized it?
Yeah, PYM was one of the convening organizations.
There were
12, and then there were 300 endorsing organizations of the conference. Yeah,
wow.
So it really shows that way that this was a convening space.
That's so great. So,
and a special shout out to Manadal Herzallah, who has been on this program before, who was also with the U.S. Palestinian Community Network and was a big organizer too. So shout out to him.
Yeah. Shout out to him, our fearless leader of our movement.
That's great. So speaking of movement, what after Detroit, what do you see coming out of this conference? What would you say are the next steps for the movement?
Yeah, thank you for this question. This is, I think, what was one of the largest things that people wanted to take away. People wanted to understand we've done all of this work. We've confronted Zionism. We've boycotted. We've done it within our workplaces. We've sailed to Gaza. We've gone to Palestine and done direct, you know, international solidarity movement work, etc. What do we need to do now to make sure this genocide ends? Because we're 2 years in, we're seeing today, in the last 24 hours, Israel has bombed hospitals, high-rise residential buildings, has now trying to clear out all of Gaza City, which is, you know, the home of the displaced, obviously, of 1 million Palestinians. So the conditions are getting exponentially worse to a degree that we didn't know it could get. And people are wanting to walk away saying, what do we do? one thing that I heard, at least from the Bay Area delegation, that was the biggest takeaway this year was the call for an arms embargo. Last year, it was obviously an arms embargo, an end to the genocide, an end to the siege. But even in the last week, we've seen the ways that the Israel and the United States have no intention to end this genocide anytime soon, or if ever, until all of Palestine is destroyed and resettled by Israelis. So our hopes of any elected official or anything happening from the top down is not going to happen. Anything that changes the trajectory of Gaza, of Palestine, is going to come from the bottom up. And that was reiterated by the call for a people's arms embargo. In fact, in 2024 was the People's Conference, in our first iteration, was the launch of the Mask Off Maersk campaign. Maersk became a household name because of the millions of pounds of military cargo they were shipping to the Zionist entity. It showed the way that it's not just the United States that is contributing. It's not just our tax dollars, but it's these corporations and most specifically these logistics companies that are actually responsible for shipping weapons from Oakland or from Fort Worth, Texas, or from New Jersey all the way to Israel to literally commit genocide, commit slaughter on our people. So now it's not a question of we are waiting on our elected officials or waiting on people to stop this genocide. We are, and we have to stop this genocide from the bottom up. We have to do research. We have to build coalitions. We have to build with labor unions. We have to build formations like Taxpayers Against Genocide to be able to work from the bottom up and genuinely address the weapons flow that is quite literally coming out of our backyards. And we need research to do that. So the call this year was to conduct research, to build with your local coalitions and build a people's arms embargo in your city, because it's the weapons, it's the military cargo that are fueling this genocide. And as long as Israel has the means to do that, they will continue this genocide. So it's up to us to stop it.
And the Oakland airport is implicated along with the ports, right?
It is.
Yeah. With FedEx flights.
Yes.
You know, so for listeners who want to plug in on, what's a good way for the listeners to plug into to these efforts, especially around Oakland, since a lot of our listeners are all Bay Area or broader Bay Area?
Yeah, I know we're probably short on time, so I'll keep this very quick.
We are good. We have 3.5 minutes, and I'm being precise, listeners, because it's a packed program today. So please.
Yes. Yeah. So just to give people some background, we uncovered that the Oakland airport had made 280 military cargo shipments to Israel over the first 6 months of this year.
Wow.
All of these shipments obviously had a destination of Israel. 96% of these shipments had a destination of the Nevitim Air Base. This is the home to the Israeli F-35 fleet, the crown jewel of the Israeli Air Force is what they call it. We looked into these components. We found that the Oakland airport is facilitating anywhere from screws and from small items for the F-35 all the way to bomb release units, which are fitted to drop 2,000-pound bombs all the way to Israel. And not only is Oakland been doing this for at least the past 6 months, the first 6 months of this year, but they're also one of the central nodes in this supply chain. In our analysis, we saw that Oakland just followed Fort Worth, Texas in the frequency. And Fort Worth, Texas is home to Lockheed Martin's home facilities. So Israel plays a huge role in shipping military cargo to Israel and continuing this genocide. This is not what Oakland residents consented to. And people are absolutely outraged about this, and they should be. So we are asking folks to go to armsembargonow.com, tell your friends, tell your family, spread the report, sign up for updates on the campaign. And most importantly, if you're connected to an organization, please endorse the campaign. We need people power to ensure that our city of Oakland, our beloved city, which was home to the Black Panther Party, takes action and demands our elected officials, who many think are progressive, demands these elected officials that we need to stop military cargo immediately. And just to note, this was happening under everyone's noses. So this is an opportunity for the city of Oakland to actually right its wrongs, to correct its actions, because every day that goes by is another day that we allow these military shipments to Israel to continue. And we've got to make it stop.
So well put.
Army, is it actually in the hands of the city council? Could they stop this? These flights?
Our assessment is yes. Our assessment is that the Oakland airport is being contracted. So this is most likely a contract that is happening, whether it's between the federal government, FedEx, the Oakland airport. I mean, I fly out of the Oakland airport all the time. It's unfathomable that I could be sitting on the tarmac next to a FedEx plane that's about to ship bomb release units to Israel's airbase to literally drop bombs on the people of Gaza. The Nevatim airbase is not a place where they export F-35 materials. It's a place where they keep them at home to use them in Gaza.
I'm so sorry, y'all, but I have to jump in because we are up. We're bound to a 20-minute segment, but crucial information. ArmsEmbargoNow.com. ArmsEmbargoNow.com. Organizations endorse. People check it out. This is – thank you, Rami, so much for all that you've shared today, and even more importantly for your incredible example, your activism, and look forward to being together in person as we push this struggle for liberation forward. So
absolutely. Thank you so much, Seth, and thank you so much, Tivis, for all your thoughtful questions today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Therese, you were going to say a little something.
I was going to say that...
Please say it into the microphone.
Oh, that would help, wouldn't it? I was going to say that this piece of music is...
This Shower...
By Maher Zain, and it's called Free Palestine. And here it is.
Stand up tall, this is a wake-up call. Never again, never again means never again for all. To all my people in Gaza, even though we're living far from each other, your pain is my own pain. All for one and one for all. Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
Make a choice, better be on the right side of history. No one can be free until we all are free. Enough is enough. We gotta stop this genocide.
Free, free Palestine.
Free.
Well, that was quite something. Therese, did you have a comment to make? Or are you ready to just tell us a story?
I'm actually ready to do my bit here. And I thought I would start out with a brief historical context and some reflection on the importance of remembering our stories as human beings. So the horrors of genocide taking place in Gaza today and for almost 2 years now are often confusing many people who lack knowledge of a historical context in Palestine, Israel. So briefly, even though so many books have been written on this subject through many decades, I'll attempt to explain a bit, hoping that it will be helpful to understand a little more clearly what led to this genocide. Simply put, Palestinian Arabs and a Jewish minority, both stemming from the same Semite stock, had, even before Roman times, lived relatively harmoniously together with other nationals, making up a diverse society through the centuries in the Holy Land. Christians and Muslims, as well as what was called the Arab Jews, basically were taught the same message by their religious texts: do unto others as you want them to do unto you. There was general tolerance among the varied groups, and in 1922, a census taken in Palestine by the British found that 41 different languages were spoken in Palestine. Jerusalem was considered the center of the world for centuries, and the land of Palestine was thought to be holy. And many people of the Abrahamic faith wanted to be there, of course. The Muslims ruled for about 13 centuries in Palestine, except for when the Crusaders were there for about 200 years around the turn of the first millennium. But with the age of colonialism, European powers took claim and ravaged the lands of less powerful peoples in Asia and Africa and the Americas. European Jews persecuted in Europe for centuries saw the opportunity to also claim land for themselves, and with the help of the Europeans, especially the British, decided to colonize the land of the Palestinians. England, the global power at the time, was too eager to get rid of their Jewish population and directed them to Palestine. Thus, the conflict began. And there were already people living in Palestine. Despite the famous lie that Palestine was a land without people for a people without land. The conflict continued to get worse until eventually the United Nations in 1947 divided Palestine and gave 56% of it to the Jewish colonizers. There's so much history here, and it's all available for you online if you're interested. And there's just so many books also written about the subject. So the problem was how to get rid of all the indigenous Palestinians who for centuries had been living in the land that was given to the Jewish people by the United Nations. Well, of course, it was through violence, massacres, and expulsions. 750,000 Palestinians were driven out of their homes and properties, and their villages were bulldozed, completely destroyed, so there would be nothing to even try to return to. That was the first Nakba, Arabic word, which means catastrophe. What we are seeing in the destruction of Gaza and its people today is being called the second Nakba. Israel's actions to this day are proving its goal to eliminate or dominate or both the indigenous Palestinians as well as neighboring peoples and become the empire in the Middle East. Any resistance by the occupied Palestinians has always been criminalized, demonized, and severely punished by Israel and supported by the Western governments, as we see today happening in Gaza and the West Bank. The Palestinian people have always resisted their occupiers to this day. They have never given up their right to return to their lands and homes, even as the Nakba has never stopped, culminating in what we are witnessing in Gaza today. Well, you might ask, where am I going with all this history? Remembering is a form of resistance. Over the next weeks and hopefully months, I would like to share with you bits and pieces of stories remembered by Palestinians who lived through the first Nakba in 1948. Also, there are heartbreaking stories coming out of Gaza today I can retell, some of which you may already have heard. It's vital to remember our stories and to listen to other people's stories. It's a way of understanding who we are and where we come from, how we manage to survive through the agony of war and separation from our roots, from the loss of home and family and culture, and even our dignity as human beings. We remember our painful stories so that, with the grace of God, we can heal the wounds in our past, lest we become the wounders, knowingly or unknowingly inflicting our wounds on others with deliberate ferocity and revenge. I dare say that seems to be the case happening now in Gaza. So I'll begin to briefly share my own story. I was born in Jerusalem, Palestine. There was no Israel at the time of my birth in June 1947. My family lived a short distance away in Ramallah, where my ancestors lived for centuries before. I was the last person in my family to be born in Palestine, because before my first birthday, we had to flee the massacres that were happening in Palestine, before and after Israel proclaimed itself a state in May of 1948. My dad was a teacher, and he came home from school one day and told my mother to get the kids ready because we had to leave immediately. The massacres, such as happened in Deir Yassin, were getting too close to where we lived. So we literally fled. I was the youngest of six children at the time, and my older siblings still remember that day, how they had to hide under blankets in the back of an old Ford pickup my uncle owned, and the gunshot sounds as we crossed into Jordan. But we were lucky in that we didn't end up in refugee camps when we realized that we would never be allowed to return to Palestine, as was the case of all the others who fled or were driven out. My dad was eventually able to find a teaching job with the help of the church we belonged to in Amman, Jordan. And so we began our new life as poor refugees for the next 10 years until we were able to come to America. But that's another story, and I think I'll stop here.
The book I'm discussing is Gaza Catastrophe, The Genocide in World History Perspective. Published in August 2025, it offers a carefully reasoned assessment of what the Gaza genocide reveals about the state of the world today. The author is Gilbert Achkar, an emeritus professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. He was born in Senegal and grew up in Lebanon. What the genocide reveals, in his view, is that, quote, the entire legal edifice of international rules-based order is crumbling. Achkar offers two reasons for this assessment. The first is the fact that many Western countries pushed back against bringing Israel before the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court over war crimes. The second reason has to do with the rise of the far right
and the unraveling of the rule of law within Western nations. A scholar of world affairs, Ashkar had concluded by 2009 that Israel might well commit a genocide. He foresaw a new Nakba, a catastrophe, looming on the horizon, threatening the West Bank and Gaza. If this happened, it would, in his words, be much worse in terms of killing and destruction than the catastrophic displacement of Palestinians in the first Nakba in 1948. Ashkar saw this possibility because, in his view, the Palestinian struggle could not achieve victory separately from the rest of the Arab world. He believes that as an independent nation, Palestine, quote, has no prospects unless it acts as the spearhead of the entire Arab liberation struggle. There was another equally important reason Ashkar saw catastrophe in Palestine's future. He believed that the Palestinian-Arab struggle had to go hand in hand with an effort to split Israeli-Jewish society from within. What he meant was that it is essential to separate a large portion of Israeli Jews from a belief in Zionism. But that possibility vanished, he says, when the rise of religious fundamentalism, Al-Qaeda and its offshoots, led to Israeli Jews rallying around their most reactionary leaders. Ashkar flatly rejects the notion that the tragedy unfolding in Gaza began on October 7, 2023. Instead, he finds its origins in the enormous suffering Gazans have endured since Israel occupied the Gaza Strip in the Six-Day War in 1967, and especially the suffering they experienced from the repeated Israeli invasions after Hamas took over governing the Gaza Strip in 2007. In the years prior to Hamas's rule, the 1993 Oslo Accords had failed to offer Palestinians any hope of a future state. Then, in 2006, when Hamas won the Palestinian legislative elections, the U.S. severed contact with Hamas, other factions refused to join the new government, and the U.S. and the EU suspended aid. The result was the political partition of the occupied territories into two rival authorities. The Palestinian Authority, one, governing the West Bank, and the other, Hamas, governing Gaza. Again, a single state was forestalled. To complicate the picture, Netanyahu was carrying on what Ashkar describes as a peculiar relationship with Hamas. For even as he attacked Hamas and invaded Gaza, Netanyahu supported Hamas financially, militarily, and politically for decades, right up to October 7, to ensure there would be no two-state solution. Only since October 7 have stories appeared, both in Israel and in the foreign press, revealing that relationship. Israel's occupation of Gaza has been multifaceted. In addition to its many invasions, Israel has always severely limited the amounts of food, water, and goods of every kind allowed into the Strip. As a result, most people in Gaza became poorer than ever. However, the poverty of the majority contrasted strikingly with the wealth of a privileged few. Wholesale traders, real estate and money exchange speculators, and a few industries and tourist enterprises, as well as millionaires and entrepreneurs who used the tunnels into Egypt to organize smuggling that was facilitated by Hamas. Meanwhile, Hamas was limiting the people's freedoms, including speech, opinion, belief, and educational curricula. Hamas prohibited political and cultural gatherings without prior authorization from its security teams. It imposed the hijab on women in secondary schools and universities. Eventually, the twin ills of repression and inequality gave rise to anger and protests among Chazans, leading to a mass uprising against Hamas's rule in the summer of 2023. Ashkar notes that few outside Gaza were aware that the resistance took place. It was against this backdrop of rage at Hamas that Hamas mounted the attack on October 7. Despite the reasons it could not succeed, Hamas had cultivated what Ashkar calls a mystical belief in the liberation of Palestine by means of armed struggle. This belief, in his view, unmistakably drove the attack of October 7. 2 years before the attack, Hamas held a conference in Gaza during which they adopted a blueprint for a future Palestine, including specifics ranging from a new legal system to a new Palestinian currency. This detailed planning, Ashkar believes, makes clear that Hamas had a fervent belief in a forthcoming liberation of Palestine thanks to divine intervention. He calls this way of thinking the most catastrophic miscalculation ever in the history of anti-colonial struggle. Perhaps Hamas' worst mistake, he suggests, was their disregard of the fact that Israel was led by the most far-right government in the history of the in its history. A government Ashkar calls a gang of anti-Palestinian racists who would not hesitate to seize any suitable opportunity to launch a genocidal war on the Strip and reoccupy it permanently. As for Western nations' wholehearted support for the genocide, Ashkar suggests that the bloody images of October 7 aroused in the West what he calls narcissistic compassion. By this he means that Westerners are more impacted by calamities striking people they feel are like themselves than by calamities affecting people they consider unlike themselves. Another factor underlying Western nations' support of the genocide, Ashkar says, is guilt for having abandoned Jews to the Holocaust. This guilt, he believes, drives the West's unconditional solidarity with the Zionist state at the very moment when it is ruled by people who have more in common with the Nazis than with their victims. Israel's savage bludgeoning of Gaza, Ashkar attributes to the political and ideological history of the Likud party, tracing it to what he calls a fascist-inspired strain of revisionist Zionism. This type of Zionism, he says, emerged as a campaign to incorporate into the state of Israel the entire territory of the British Mandate on both banks of the Jordan River. This revisionist Zionism criticized the laborite Zionists led by Ben-Gurion for stopping military action in 1949 before taking the West Bank and Gaza. Revisionist Zionism lives on when Cabinet Minister Bezalel Smotrich spoke to Arab deputies in the Knesset in 2021. He said, "It's a mistake that Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job and didn't throw you out in 1948. In short, the Likud regards what Israel is doing today in Gaza and the West Bank as tending to unfinished business. As the West watches and enables or murmurs scant criticism, everything proceeds according to a long-established plan."
You've been listening to Speaking of Palestine on listener-sponsored KBBF 89.1 FM. Some of the sources used in today's broadcast include J Weekly, Zateo, Forward, Truth Out, Mondawise, La Jornada, Al Jazeera, Source, and Haaretz. Speaking of Palestine can be heard on KBBF every Monday from 4 to 5, on KWTF and KRJF every Tuesday from 8 to 9, KIDE Sundays at 4. You can hear previous shows by going to archive.org, typing Rebel 2252 in the search window. It opinions expressed here reflect the views of the speakers, not those of KBBF its staff or board of directors. Thanks for listening. This show will repeat next Monday. We'll be back in 2 weeks with an all-new edition of Speaking of Palestine.